Our first case is 20-2128 United States v. Twaddle, and for the appellant, Ms. Stillinger, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, we have raised several issues on Mr. Twaddle's behalf, but I'd like to talk about the first issue that we raised. I think it is the most substantial issue and most worthy of the court's attention. And that is the issue of the trial court allowing the government to introduce evidence of Mr. Twaddle's 2016 methamphetamine possession and distribution as 404B evidence in this case involving a September of 2017 incident. So that evidence was introduced both through testimony of an agent and then also through a photograph. And that photograph is Government's Exhibit 42. It is a photograph of Mr. Twaddle without his shirt on and showing his tattoos and holding a bag with an ounce of methamphetamine in it. And then there was testimony about the surrounding circumstances, that he was selling it that ounce to an informant. Looking at the Huddleston factors, and the first one was really our main objection to this, was that there was no proper purpose for the introduction of this evidence. The government said, well, the government alleged several purposes, but the court ended up allowing it specifically for the purpose of showing an intent to distribute. And what we argued, and I think this is true, is that was not a proper purpose. This case that Mr. Twaddle was prosecuted for involved 2 pounds, a little less than 2 pounds of methamphetamine. We know that intent to distribute can be inferred from that quantity. And in fact, there's a specific instruction. The jury is instructed, you may infer an intent to distribute. So if they found that he possessed that quantity, then intent to distribute is actually not an issue. It is inferred.
Did you stipulate to intent?
No, Your Honor.
And the government has to prove it, and the jury has to find it.
Well, Your Honor, there was discussion about a stipulation. They asked if he would stipulate. I don't know how we could have done a stipulation to intent to distribute without at least implying that he possessed it.
Right. That may be true. The trouble is the government does have to prove it and the jury does have to find it. So I guess I struggle to see why it's not an issue for the jury.
And Your Honor, it is an issue for the jury. But what I'm saying is that a stipulation would have essentially been the same as the court's instruction, which is if you find that he possessed this quantity, you may infer an intent to distribute. And that would have essentially been the nature of a stipulation, but a stipulation.
That would just be saying you may infer. It doesn't require the jury to infer. I thought you actually tried to challenge the inference from the wiretap conversations that your client intended to distribute the drug.
Well, Your Honor, what we were challenging from the wiretaps was the quantity involved. And our real defense as to these 2 pounds was that there was insufficient evidence that he possessed that quantity. So our defense was a factual issue of actual possession. So the wiretap talks, and essentially, I did say in closing argument, yes, it does appear that they're talking about drug transactions. I believe I even said in closing argument, you could say the telephone counts. Yes, I mean, the telephone count doesn't require a specific drug. It doesn't require a specific quantity. But we were not actually challenging distribution as opposed to possession. No, that was never part of the defense.
Coming back to Judge Moritz's question, it sounds to me that your objection is not so much whether the testimony was for a proper purpose. It sounds to me like it's more that it was cumulative or prejudicial because I mean, I think our case law is pretty clear. You can infer intent from a previous drug transaction. In fact, we had a case just a couple weeks ago, Tennyson, that stands for that proposition. Can you distinguish your case from Tennyson, or I've asked you really two questions. Did I misinterpret whether this was prejudicial evidence rather than proper purpose evidence?
Well, so a couple of things. I do believe it was more prejudicial than relevant, but than probative rather. Let me just cite what the government argued in closing argument, because I think that shows how it was actually used. The government said in closing, and this is at volume 2, page 896, that evidence of the 2016 sale was admitted to help us prove the point that he is, in fact, intending to distribute meth, because we know he distributed it on that day in October 2016. So to me, that sounds like the government is saying he did it before, so we know he did it now. Here's another part of the prejudice angle, Your Honor, is that the testimony about that incident was that he sold to an informant. I mean, that evidence was rock solid. They had him on tape. They had him on photographs. They had a picture of it with it in his hand. He was not prosecuted for that. And the jury knew he was not prosecuted for that. And I think that actually adds to the prejudice of that prior evidence, because a jury is hearing this. He's done it before. He didn't get prosecuted for it. And I think that invites them to forgive some of the gaps in the evidence in the case that is actually on trial. And when I went back and looked at the record, because I didn't exactly remember this, but I spent a good half of my closing argument talking about why they should not consider that 2016 event as evidence that he did it this time, why they should not consider the guns as evidence that he is guilty in this case. Those are things that make him look like a bad person. It is very prejudicial.
Why do you say the jury knew he had not been prosecuted for the earlier transaction? He obviously wasn't being prosecuted in this case. How did they know he had not been prosecuted on the earlier transaction? In an earlier federal case or in a state prosecution?
Your Honor, I can't cite you to that right now, but that was in the agent's testimony about that incident.
The agent said that he was not prosecuted for it?
I would be happy to confirm that and follow up if I'm wrong about that. I'd be happy to let the court know, but I'm fairly certain that that came out in his testimony, yes.
Without objection? I mean, if your concern is they're going to convict him this time because he wasn't prosecuted in the prior occasion, then the time for you to object, I would think, would be when the evidence comes out that he wasn't prosecuted the prior time. If you didn't object to that evidence, that weakens your argument about the prejudice here.
I see your point, Your Honor, and I can't say that I disagree that that would have been an independent objection. Of course, I was objecting to the whole line of evidence and probably honestly did not think of objecting to that separately, Your Honor. In any event,
I forgive you for that. I just don't think, I think that's fine that you did. Go ahead. You've got a tough road to hoe here, given our precedent, I would think.
Well, and frankly, I mean, there was a lot of bad evidence in this case. And, you know, I addressed this with the jury. I mean, there were lots of phone calls, lots of text messages. It appears that there was drug trafficking going on. And that's one of the reasons I'm saying I don't think intent to distribute was ever really an issue in this case. And I simply did not see how we could stipulate to intent without appearing to admit possession. But there were lots of discussions. There was a lot of speculation about quantities. A cutie pie means this. A bag of dog food means this. Keeping in mind that October 2016 incident was 1 ounce. Now, this case is 30 times that much, or 32 times. It's 2 pounds. So we have increased, you know, a great deal.
And so, counsel, I'm sorry.
Yes, ma'am. I'm sorry.
I think one other thing I think the government is pointing to, and I'd like you to address, is that it was relevant to show intent with respect to his defense, I guess, was that at least one of his defenses was that when he agreed in one of the wiretap calls to pay $5,000, his defense is he was paying $5,000 for a BMW. I think the
That's
government
correct.
Argues, at least in their brief, that this was relevant for intent to show that, you know, that wasn't essentially to rebut the defense, essentially.
Well, I think the specific conversation about that evening was something about 5-4-2, take two, leave five. And the agent testified that means £2, $5,000. Of course, actually, you know, there was other evidence that a pound cost $5,000, not 2 pounds cost $5,000. And it was in evidence. I mean, the agent agreed that he knew that Mr. Twaddle had bought a vehicle, the BMW that he was arrested in. He had bought that from Ramirez, the guy, I think his name was Ramirez, the guy that whose house he left the money at. So, but I see what you're saying with that, with the evidence of intent. I still don't think it was specifically intent to distribute was the alleged proper purpose. So I still think it does not go to that. I wanted to mention one other aspect of the prejudice part of this, which is the photograph, because I had a discussion with Judge Brack in trial about the fact that it was a video and we, you know, they pared it down to a still photograph, but Mr. Twaddle is there without a shirt. He's got his tattoos. And, this is sort of one of those things, a picture is worth 1,000 words, right? I mean, he looks terrible in that picture. And that is something that I objected to, the way that it looked. I know we had a little discussion about Judge Brack said, well, what about Adam Levine? He takes his shirt off, he has tattoos. And it was, you know, frankly, kind of a lighthearted discussion. But I think that added to the prejudice in this case as well, is that the way somebody looks, I mean, defendant gets to dress for court, so that they don't look like a criminal. And I don't think there was a proper, that just increased the prejudice on this case. I'm surprisingly getting close to the 2 minutes that I wanted to try to leave for rebuttal, if I may.
You may. Thank you, counsel. Let's hear from government. There you go.
Good morning, Your Honor. Sorry it took me a while to unmute there. My name is Emil Keeney. I'm here for the United States, and may it please the court. There's a number of points I'd like to make about the 404B issue that we've been discussing. The first is that there was a proper purpose for it. The government is required to prove that the defendant intended to distribute methamphetamine. And at trial, a defense counsel declined to stipulate to that element. And in fact, what the discussion that Judge Brack had, which we quote in our brief, is he pointed out to the defense that it's not enough to say that someone could infer intent to distribute from the quantity of drugs involved. The government has to prove that it's Mr. Twaddle who intended to distribute the drugs. And the defense would not stipulate to that. The defense, in fact, argued, as has been mentioned today, that there were innocent explanations for his wiretap discussions with Marcos Martinez, his supplier, that dog didn't really mean dog, didn't really mean methamphetamine. It could have meant dog because he had a dog. They may have really been talking about biscuits and so forth. But you'll find that if you look in volume 2 at pages 910 to 913 of Ms. Stillinger's closing argument, she makes those points. And she also points out that, yes, the payment of $5,000 delivered at midnight and left in a car could have been payment for the BMW that Twaddle purchased from his supplier. So we think the district court got it right. There's a proper purpose for this evidence, and it's relevant. And with respect to prejudice, this court has held several times, numerous times maybe, that the engaging in a prior drug sale is irrelevant under Rule 404B to prove intent on this occasion. And with respect to the propensity analysis, we've cited this court's decision in Moran, which says, this court said there is a kind of propensity evidence involved in this sort of evidence, but it's not an improper, it's not general character evidence that the defendant is a bad person, and it doesn't cause a sort of prejudice, the kind of prejudice that's relevant under 403 is whether the evidence suggests a basis for a decision to the jury that's improper or some kind of emotional basis. So if we had evidence that Twaddle had engaged in some spectacular or horrific crime that was entirely separate from this transaction or his drug dealing activities, that's the sort of thing that this court's talking about. So,
counsel, yes. Could I get you to move to the argument we didn't address in appellants with appellants counsel, but the 2D1, 1B1, the enhancement for possessing a dangerous weapon.
Yes.
I have some questions. I guess I'm not understanding how the government proved, at least by a preponderance of the evidence, that the guns bore any kind of spatial or temporal relationship to the drug transactions themselves. I mean, all we really have about the guns is a phone call that he made, Mr. Twaddle made from jail later in the day he was arrested to his girlfriend, Moreno, saying that he, basically talking about moving the guns. What else do we have besides that to connect these guns with the various transactions?
Well, I think the district court, I think there were a number of items from that conversation, as well as the agent's surveillance, that combined allowed the court to draw the inference that he had guns while he was conducting his drug transactions.
Tell me about the agent's surveillance. How did they know that there were guns in the house during, or where they were in the house for that matter?
Well, they don't, but the inference I would draw is that we asked the district court to draw, I think, is that first of all, they showed their surveillance showed that he lived there, that he spent time there. Mm-hmm. That was the only place he lived. They didn't see any indication they lived anywhere else. So we have that. The second item we have from their surveillance is that he's engaging in drug activity from that house.
Mm-hmm.
The surveillance of it, he arranged to meet with his supplier, he said, let's meet at my pad, let's meet at my place. And then agents mm-hmm. would see, and then the poll camera would show Mr. Martinez, the supplier, going to that residence. So he's conducting them from there. So now going back to the phone conversation,
mm-hmm.
As you've already mentioned, he admits in that conversation, it's clear he has guns and he has them during the course of his drug trafficking activity.
But where that conversation doesn't say where they were, whether they were in
That's
the
right.
house, whether they were out of the house, if they were in the house, were they in the attic, were they loaded, were they unloaded? You got nothing that I can see.
What we do have is that Mr. Twaddle and his girlfriend were concerned about two things in that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
First, they were concerned that his property might be stolen, including his firearms.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of their concerns. The other concern is they're not sure, and you can see in that conversation, it's Exhibit 23A, in the one of the volumes of the supplemental record, and you can read the entire conversation. But the other thing they're concerned about is they don't know whether police know about his methamphetamine trafficking. So the inference we would draw from that is first, his property, including his guns, are somewhere he can protect them
mm-hmm.
when he's out of jail, and not somewhere he can protect them when he's in jail.
Yeah, I'm still failing to see. Let's say we can draw an inference from that conversation, and I think it's a stretch. that the guns were in the house that he lived in part of the time at the time of that conversation. If we can draw that inference, how does that still get you to the guns were in the house, loaded somewhere near the various transactions when they occurred? I mean, I don't see that next inference, or maybe a triple inference we've got going here. How do you get there?
I would say that combining the fact that he doesn't, this is where he lives, this is where he conducts his drug activities, and the agents conducting surveillance don't see him living or engaging anywhere else.
Right. Do you have any case law that would say that type of evidence allows you to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the enhancement would apply here?
No, I haven't found any.
I haven't seen anything very close to that. That's for sure.
That's on point. That's right. This close. And I want to say too, the district court said this is a close call.
Yes, he did.
I'm not here telling you that this is overwhelming evidence.
Right.
Wait. Mr. Keeney, who has the burden of persuasion on this point?
Oh, we have the burden of proof by a preponderance of evidence, and I think I don't know.
No, you don't. That's not my understanding. We've said the government bears the burden of proving possession by a preponderance of the evidence. Once the government has met that burden, the commentary to the rule, to the guideline, creates an exception to the blanket rule that mere proximity is sufficient. It states that the enhancement is inappropriate if the evidence suggests that it is clearly improbable that the gun was connected to the offense.
Right.
So the burden here, as I understand it, but apparently you don't understand it this way, so I must be missing something. My understanding is it's the defendant's burden to show that it's clearly improbable that the gun was connected to the offense. And so...
Once the government shows possession, right?
Yeah.
The government first has the burden to show possession.
Right. That was his gun. That seems to be a reasonable inference in the circumstances. Where I'm bothered is by the introduction of the gun from the shed in case in chief, not for purposes of sentencing. I don't see how that made it at all more likely that the defendant committed the offense. It may have been harmless error, but I have a hard time seeing why that was admissible. We have some language and precedent that helps you, but it doesn't seem very persuasive to me. So I'm asking two questions, one with respect to the guideline, and am I missing something on who has the burden here?
Well,
and the admission of the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, on your first point, I would really like to be able to agree with you, but the government does have the burden to prove possession, and I think that's what's in dispute here, is whether we prove by preponderance of the evidence, enough evidence that the district court could draw the inference that he possessed the guns.
Possession, isn't it just more than that? It's in connection with, it has to be in connection with the offense. The day he was arrested, we have some inference that he possessed the gun that day. It has to be more than that.
Right. We would have to prove that he possessed the guns in proximity. And that's what I meant. We need to prove that they're tied to his, that he had them close by when he's conducting his drug activity.
The temporal and spatial relationship.
Correct.
That's correct. So what you're saying is the guidelines. Okay. You're saying that the burden on the government isn't just to show that he possessed the guns. The government has the burden to show that he possessed the guns in proximity to the offense, and then the defendant has to show it was clearly unrelated.
That's my understanding, sir. Pardon, I'm sorry.
Okay, well, that's the question then, whether the proximity has to be shown before the burden shifts to the defendant to show it was clearly unrelated to the offense.
And that's the way I understand it, Your Honor. If you all disagree with me, I'm happy to have you disagree.
Well, but that's whatever the
Mr. Caney, was your theory on the firearms that they were in the house and Ms. Pearson put them in the shed, or that they were in the shed the entire time he was, after he was arrested until they were found by the, or found during the search?
With respect to the enhancement, there's two parts of that, Your Honor. And Judge Hartz alluded to one part of it earlier. But there's the enhancement, and then there's the admission of the photographs at trial. So with respect to the enhancement, I don't think it matters. I don't think the government thought it mattered whether they were in the shed or when they were in the shed, because we were relying primarily on the telephone conversation and the inferences that I was describing in response to Judge Moritz's question. But with respect to the firearms in the shed, yes, I believe at trial the government's theory was that they were not in the shed at the time the drug transactions were taking place from the house, and that they must have been put there later. And the reason we think they weren't in the shed at the time is because during the telephone conversation after the arrest, they talk about putting his property in the shed, which implies that it wasn't there already. So yes, that is our theory. And we would rely on the same inference with respect to the trial issue. If I don't know if I'm done with your question or if I can move back to Judge Hartz.
I thought the government or the law enforcement had the key to the shed.
So I forget how they got into the shed, Your Honor, to tell you the truth.
I know, but how would his girlfriend get in the shed if there was no key?
We don't know if she picked it up from the, because they did discuss the possibility of her picking it up from the police station and getting him to authorizing Twaddle to release it to her, or whether the owner of the property, Mr. Eastman, might have had it. We don't know.
Okay.
But going back to Judge Hartz's question about the trial issue, I think we would rely on the same inferences we relied on before, plus the fact that we described, or that they described in their conversation, the possibility of hiding them there in the shed. I understand that Mr. Twaddle was opposed to that, but we think the district court could infer that she did so anyway, or someone did so. But the other point I have is, if you disagree with me on that, and you say it wasn't properly admitted, we think it was harmless error given all of the other abundant evidence of drug trafficking, consciousness of guilt from his flight, and finding the drugs less than a mile from where he stopped. So I see that my time is up. Unless you have any other questions, I would ask that you affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Caney. We have some rebuttal time.
Thank you. I want to address the guns just briefly first, because I want to remind you the conversation that Mr. Twaddle had with his girlfriend, Moreno. She said, why don't we put them in the shed? And he said, no, don't put them in the shed. Take them to my mother or my brother, is what he said. So, yes, there's a possibility that she did put them in the shed. But also keeping in mind the owner of this property, Mr. Eastman, Sean Eastman, also lived at that house. The girlfriend lived at this house. Mr. Twaddle, yes, he stayed there because he stayed with his girlfriend most of the time, but there were other people that could have had guns in that shed, and there's no real tie to show that Mr. Twaddle kept his guns there. Keeping in mind, too, the search is 1 month after his arrest, so he hasn't had any access to that shed for a month. They've recorded all of his jail calls, and the one call about the gun is the one that I just recounted to you. Government's Exhibit 36 is a photograph of one of the guns. It is a .22, which is not typically associated with drug trafficking, but it's a .22 with a high-capacity magazine, three high-capacity magazines. I think it's a very prejudicial photograph, and although I started with Issue 1, that's my second issue, is the 403 considerations on allowing evidence of these guns. I don't think there was a proper purpose to that. And I think it was very prejudicial, especially that photograph with the high capacity magazines. I did want to touch on the cases cited by the government as to Issue 1, which is Moran, and then also Ramirez. Both of those cases, talking about Moran, which says, yes, you can bring in evidence of a prior felon in possession conviction to show felon in possession on this instance, but it was a constructive possession case. So it was a constructive possession, and they said then the defendant's knowledge is important, and the defendant's knowledge does seem to be enhanced by his prior conviction for the same thing. They did talk about the fact that, yes, there is some prejudice there, but it's a legitimate purpose. Another case cited by the government along those lines is Ramirez. It's a 1995 Tenth Circuit case. That is a drug case where they said you can bring in a prior possession, but again, it is a constructive possession. So the defendant's knowledge of the drugs was the key. And in Moran, it was the knowledge of the firearm. They're both constructive possession cases, which this was not. So I don't think they're truly applicable. And I see my time is up unless you have any questions.
Thank you, counsel. I appreciate the fine arguments. You are excused and the case is submitted.